So what does the future hold for all of us? Weaponizing viruses, energy crunches. In a moment, Terry Hayes joins us. His latest work, I Am a Pilgrim. We'll talk about that next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Let me tell you a little bit about Terry Hayes. Migrated to Australia as a child, trained as a journalist at 21. He was appointed a North American correspondent based out of New York, and after a few years, returned back to Australia to become an investigative reporter, political correspondent, columnist. And then a short time later, with George Miller, they wrote the screenplay for Road Warrior Mad Max 2. You remember that? He also co-produced and wrote Dead Calm, the film which launched Nicole Kidman's international movie career, and Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome and a host of other miniseries, then moved to Los Angeles, working as a screenwriter on major studio productions. Here's Terry Hayes on Coast to Coast. Hey, Terry, I got to look you up when I get back to Los Angeles. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
I am super indeed. You got to tell me all about yourself. We're going to have some fun for the next 3 hours, but I'm in Missouri right now in St. Louis. Do you have a Missouri connection at all?
I was there a couple of days ago. I've been 14 cities in 16 days traveling across America, and seeing parts of America I hadn't seen for years, some I'd never seen. And I'd first gone to St. Louis, I guess, 35 years ago. Things had changed a fair bit, George.
They sure have. Now, how did you end up in Australia originally?
Back in the early 1950s, the Australian government felt that 6 million people in a land area the size of America just wasn't enough. And so they offered a very generous migration program. You could take the whole of your family, didn't matter how many kids you had, you could take them to Australia for $20. My parents had two kids, so it cost us $5 each member of the family to get there. What they didn't tell you was that if you didn't like it, you had to pay them back thousands of dollars.
That's right.
If you wanted to go back.
How many people went back?
Well, mostly because, you know, it was just after the war in Britain and nobody had any money. So I never knew anybody that went back, which didn't actually mean everybody was happy, but they stayed and made a life there.
I remember watching Road Warrior, Mad Max. It launched Mel Gibson's career, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. Yeah, there's no doubt of that. And, he went on to have, well, we all know what career he had. But it was a strange thing, George, you know. It was made for under $3 million. And, it's just a group of people, a fairly small crew in Australia. We go out 600 miles west of Sydney to a mining town called Broken Hill, and we make it out there. We make the movie out there, you know. On that movie were three people who went on to win Oscars. Now, what are the chances of that when you've got a very small crew and you come from Australia and nobody's ever heard of any of you?
That's true. It really, I run into him, Terry, a couple times when I'm back in Los Angeles. I have always found him to be very nice and pleasant. I don't know him socially at all, but I mean, he's just a very nice guy. And Robert Davi, who's a well-known actor out in L.A., I was talking to him on the phone. I said, hey, Mel Gibson's right, couple tables from me. And he said, buy him tea, don't buy him a drink. He won't drink it. And he's trying to fight his demons, isn't he?
He's been trying to fight his demons, I think, probably his whole life. And, I've known Mel, I guess, it must be getting on for 35 years now. And, they have a saying in AA, which, I guess we've all heard at one time or another, that you're not a bad person, trying to be good. You're a sick person trying to get well.
Yeah.
And Mel's acknowledged, I think publicly, but certainly in many conversations I've had with him, that life's been a battle for him. And, in all that time I've known him, in all of the many years and many extreme situations, and known his family very well, all I can say is I never heard him say anything that I think could be counted as offensive. I mean, he tells some really terrible jokes, I will say that.
he does. And, I would say the same thing. He was nothing but polite. And, you just got caught up in something. And, but what a great talent, Terry. I mean, what a great talent he is.
Yeah. And not just in front of the, camera, George, behind the camera. And, you know, that takes, it's a very, very special quality, in my view, to be able to direct a movie, especially a big, complex action movie, something like Braveheart. So to act in it, to be a co-producer of it, and to be a director, that is an incredible workload. And to pull that off to the level that he did, that is really a rare talent. And, it's just a tragedy, what has occurred and, all of the stuff around that. But, I hope, for him personally, as well as, creatively, that he's going to come back. It's a great loss, especially with him as a director.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, Apocalypto was a great movie that he did. He just seems like everything he touches is top notch. I loved him in Braveheart, The Patriot. I mean, he's just a great, great everything he does.
Yeah, Ransom. I mean, the Ron Howard directed movie, that was a terrific piece of work on his part. He directed a movie called Man Without a Face, which, was the first thing he ever directed. Lots of people, I think America's blessed. It has some just outstanding actors. Australia's had a few too. Being a director is a whole different thing. And that's a much, in my view anyway, a much rarer talent.
Terry, when you think back to the Mad Max time and, think about what could happen in the future, that is one scary movie because it could happen.
And it almost did. It almost did. I mean, we've only got to think back to the Arab oil embargo.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, how many times has the Middle East blown up and gas prices have gone through the roof?
That's right. Absolutely.
But George, I mean, we got a fair time ahead of us, and maybe I could take one minute to tell you that the opening of Road Warrior, which, for those of who can't remember it or never saw it, it's a lot of archival footage about, really the way the world might go to the brink and then over the edge. And I was the producer of a radio program in Australia, Australia's top rating current affairs radio program. And you know what it's like. Sometimes days are a bit slower than others. And I came up with a brilliant idea. I said, you know what we should do? We should do a story about how things might really blow up. What is going to take us right to the brink? The host of the show said, gee, that's a good idea. And I said, yeah, sort of like a bit like War of the Worlds, but...
reality.
Sorry?
But a reality, basically.
Exactly. So I set to and got writing, and what we did was we did them as news flashes and then some pseudo interviews. But every 2 minutes we were saying to our audience, this is not true. This is just a version of how we think things are going to really fall apart. Well, George, it was fascinating because everybody heard the really bad stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody seemed to hear the disclaimers.
They never do, Terry.
Well, yeah. So I learned. I wish you'd have told me that beforehand.
I know it. They for some reason they blotted out.
Yeah, and I think it was because it was so believable. I think we touched on a deep and underlying anxiety that people have, and I think especially when we were doing that scenario, people were thinking, I believe this. And so people were going down to school to get their kids. Nearly lost our job. The radio station nearly lost its license.
Wow.
And I never forgot it. Well, how could you? A couple of years later, George Miller and I are sitting around, and he said to me, hey, do you want to write a movie? And this is Australia. I said, sure, why not? And he said, how do you think we could start, you know, this Mad Max movie? And that whole event went into my head. And I said to him, George, you know, there's something out there. There's something that people respond to. And I told him the story. And then he recalled it because, you know, it got a fair amount of publicity. And he said, let's start it that way. Let's start it that we're going to, you know, that we're going to go to war over oil. The fuel's going to run out. And we'll do it as archival footage, you know, drawn from black and white newsreels. You can write some narration, and then we'll use that to launch the story. And we did.
That's super. It just, and it worked perfectly. How did they find Mel Gibson to star in this?
Well, what had happened, well, Mel had gone to the National Institute of Dramatic Art in Sydney in Australia. And George Miller, you know, who went on to win the Oscar and be nominated a couple of times, he's always had a great interest in acting, which, frankly, a lot of directors don't. They find actors a bit difficult. But he'd always had a great interest. Mel had appeared on a couple of very small TV shows, you know, struggling actor, young guy, working down in Adelaide, doing some theatre work, and that. But, you know, there was nothing very, there was nothing like that jumped out at you as far as his career was concerned. George had had the idea that in Mad Max that, you know, that the character should be 15 or 16 years old. He thought he should be really young, and the world had gone to tell in such a way that it was kids out there.
Yeah, and the adults were gone, huh?
Yeah, yeah. And that it just proved too difficult for George to find somebody of that age who he felt confident enough that he could, you know, hang a movie on. And then Mel came in for a casting session, you know, which is one of many, many people that came in. And George, you know, God bless him, in that instant, felt that he had all the qualities that, you know, there's a vulnerability to Mel. Mm-hmm. There's a wounded nature to him. He's a very complex man. And at that stage, like all of us, George, he was fantastically good-looking.
Yeah, and he looked young, right?
Yeah, very young, and he had that innocence about him. But, you know, there was a lot of pain in the past. So George felt in that moment that Mel, you know, was the one. He never doubted it. He never doubted it. Funnily enough, some years later, we did a movie called Dead Calm, and we had worked with Nicole Kidman on a couple of miniseries, but we both felt that about Nicole, and she was 16 at the time.
That is amazing. And I bet she was just as tall as she is now.
Yes, just as tall, and I've got to say, a truly, truly wonderful person to work with. So I've been blessed. You know, Mel was terrific to work with. There was no petulant behavior. And yeah, I did a movie called Payback with Mel. Same thing. No petulant behavior, no silliness. Same with Nicole. And I think that's partly because in Australia you don't, you know, the sort of nonsense that you read about often, it just isn't tolerated down there. I mean, it's a small industry. Everybody knows each other, and you sort of just get on and do it.
Well, yeah, I got to tell you, there's a lot of talented people, as you know, Terry, from Australia. We even have a great guest on our program, and she's a witch, and her name is Fiona Horn. She's from Australia, and she's just a delight. She really is.
Yeah, yeah. I think, you know, I mean, in America, in that, it's such a huge country, such a huge population, and, you know, but down in Australia, yeah, it's a huge country, but it's still only got 22, 23 million people, and I think that you know, there's still a certain attitude that Australians have, which is, you know, to do with a sense of community, a strong sense of nationhood, a strong sense of what we are as people. And I think that, you know, that sort of stands us in relatively good stead, whether it's our sporting heroes or our screen actors and that. I think they're pretty well characterized as being, you know, down-to-earth people.
Well, I spent a lot of time coming back to talk with you about energy policy and where you think the future is going to go with us. But let's talk a little bit about your new book, I Am Pilgrim, because very well done, very scary, that talks about, of course, you know, the manufacturing of disease viruses out there that could just wipe out the entire planet. How in the heck, Terry, did you come up with that?
I got scared, George. I got scared. You know, I've been a journalist, as you mentioned earlier, a foreign correspondent. I've always, you know, and I think the history of Mad Max shows, you know, I've always been sort of very interested in you know, that what's happening more out on the leading edge. You know, what are we confronting? I've got four young kids myself, and, you know, like I think anybody, you start to think of the world they're going to inherit. But I read a lot, and I talked to some people, and you know, these are not, you know, alarmist people, or that you know, people I respect, highly intelligent people, and a number of them, a couple of them, you know, working in the, you know, the scientific fields, mm-hmm. had mentioned to me that, you know, there's this great saying that generals are always fighting the last war. They never fight the next war, mm-hmm. the one that's coming up.
Right.
And you know, and I don't mean to disparage this. We were living in Florida, my wife and I, when 9/11 happened. And please, I found that as shocking as anybody in the world. And but I have to tell you that flying, you know, passenger jets, using them as guided missiles into buildings, is dial up. You know, and mm-hmm. we're in the broadband era, and we're not going to see things like that again. I'm afraid the threats that face us are far more existential than that, far more serious, because of the hemorrhaging of information on the internet,
yes.
because of the advances in biological engineering and the free availability, not just of information, but of equipment that you would never have been able to buy or afford just 10 years ago.
I think you're right. We're going to have dirty bombs, viruses, everything that high technology can come up with. I don't think it's a matter of if. It's just a matter of when, Terry.
Absolutely. And that was the thing that scared me. Because the people I spoke to, what I read, the people, you know, who are deeply embedded in the science of, you know, bioengineering and that, they were saying exactly what you just said. It's not if, it's when. Will it be this year? I hope not. Do I think it will happen in the next 10 years? Absolutely. Look, I remember, you may too, I remember standing in an office, oh, I don't know, 30 years ago or something, and watching a piece of paper being printed out that somebody had sent down a telephone line. And it was called a fax. And I couldn't work out how that worked. And we all stood around, George Miller, myself, and a few other people, scratching our heads, saying, wow,
I'm going to tell you a funny fact story in a minute, Terry, but we're going to come back. We're going to talk more about your work, I Am Pilgrim, and some other incredible stories on Coast to Coast AM. With our special guest, Terry Hayes, who's with us as we talk about his work, I Am Pilgrim, and some other things he's done in his career. Hey, by the way, Beyond Belief is our television program, internet-based. If you haven't had a chance to look at it yet, you can take a peek at it for 10 days free. Simply go to the website, beyondbelief.com. That's www.beyondbelief.com. And welcome back. We're back with Terry Hayes. Terry, you're right. When the fax machine first came out, what a marvelous piece of equipment, wasn't it?
It was incredible. And here's the even more incredible thing, George. They're obsolete.
They really are. I mean, I still use it because I don't have a scanner. But, and I like hard copies. I don't have to worry about going to print it all up and everything. But you're right. They're becoming obsolete.
Yeah, it's all email. And that, now, that's in a relatively short time. It's happening all around us with technology. And unfortunately, the technology of manufacturing, you know, highly destructive weapons in your garage is with us.
It sure is. I remember when the fax first came out, I had a person in my office. I gave her a fax and I said, I need you to send this. And so she did. And she came back and said, you didn't go through. And I saw the little notice, you know, how the end of a fax after you send it, it shows you a little printout. And I said, no, it went through. She said, no, it didn't go through. I said, no, it went through. They have it. And she looks at me. She's so flustered. And she said, it didn't go through. How could it go through? I'm holding it still in my hand. She actually thought it would dematerialize like a Star Trek thing and just float through the air and it would show up physically on the other side that way.
She might be right in another 5 or 10 years.
That's true. That is true. But technology just really changes. Now, here's the thing, though, with your work with I Am Pilgrim. How do we know that the creation, let's say, of these viruses that are unleashed on people aren't done by the people that we expect to protect us?
You don't know. That's the tragedy. Look, you know, in the book, without giving away too much, but in the book, it's the weaponizing of the smallpox virus. Smallpox is, the greatest killer the world's ever known. The estimate is that it's since, man started to walk upright, that 100 billion people have died from smallpox. Okay. That is the gold standard of all, really bad pathogens, and the gold standard if you want to really, develop a weapon. How do we know that you can engineer that? How do we know that you can take tiny chemical letters, which you can buy over the internet, glue them together virtually, and create a virus? Well, we do know this because in upstate New York, a group of scientists working at a university there did that with a virus, and it was the polio virus, right? So how did they get the money to do this? The Pentagon gave them the money. Why did the Pentagon do such a thing? Because it wanted to find out if you could glue little chemical pieces together and make a virus. So I'm sitting around in the Middle East, not sure whether you can do this, but the Pentagon very kindly has proved to me that you can. So there is this one small example of the left-hand of government not knowing what the right-hand of government's doing. That was publicly known. God knows what is happening at Fort Detrick, the Center for all, biological weapons in America. You don't know. And there's enough evidence out there of all governments. Far be it from me to criticize the American government because, I can point to the Australian government. I can point to the English government, you can point to just about any government that feels that it has some sort of mandate to do things which it knows the population might not agree with.
So true. They say that the last real natural occurring case of smallpox was in 1977. I didn't know that.
Yeah. A young girl, and it was on an island, I think, off the coast of India, but I could be wrong about that. But here's the thing, you see, what occurred was that, and this is about technological change, as smallpox was eradicated from the world. It's probably the greatest achievement of medical science ever. Interesting enough, nobody ever won a Nobel Prize for it, but it is without doubt the biggest killer of our species that you can find, eradicated from the world, and that's a wonderful achievement. So what does the World Health Organization do? After a few years, it says, there's no more smallpox, so we don't need vaccines anymore. So all the stockpiles, the worldwide stockpiles of vaccine were destroyed. primarily because they're expensive to maintain. You're never quite sure, unless you keep testing them, that they're still effective.
Right.
You don't need a vaccine if you haven't got a disease.
Right. And a bad vaccine, Terry, could be a disaster.
I beg your pardon, George. I'm sorry.
A bad vaccine can be a disaster, worse than the virus.
Absolutely. A bad vaccine, if for no other reason, it lulls you all into everybody into a false sense of security.
Yes.
And that, but let alone that the health consequences of bad vaccines. In a lot of people, I mean, not a lot of people, but in a reasonable percentage of people, vaccines don't take anyway. So, but the World Health Organization, for reasons which I think we can all understand, says, well, we don't have a disease, so why have a vaccine? So they destroy them. Nobody at that stage anticipated what the future course of events might be, that in regard to biological weapons, we might be back with the fax machine. Everything might have changed so fast that all of the rules were different. Everybody knew there were two examples of the smallpox virus still in existence, one at the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta and one at a Russian facility called Vector. Okay, that's supposed to be for research purposes, supposed to be. Nobody knows if North Korea's got it. Nobody knows if Syria's got it. Nobody knows if a number of other failed states might have acquired it somewhere along the line.
Oh, boy, that's all we need.
Yeah, but we do know one thing. We do know one thing, that Russia developed 20 metric tons of smallpox to load on warheads if, you know, things really
get out of hand,
came apart. And that was not just smallpox. That's what's known as vaccine-evasive smallpox, that any known vaccine, it could evade any known vaccine. And it's possible to manufacture or to genetically engineer smallpox to make it vaccine evasive, and that's the weapon that I use in the book. Can you do that at home? Well, there are people who say, as you mentioned before, it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. And
That's right.
That is truly a scary development.
I'm looking at a picture, Terry, of a little girl from Bangladesh who's infected with smallpox. We'll put a link up on Coast to Coast AM in a moment. But the most hideous-looking virus I think I've ever seen. It is on 110% of her body. It's everywhere. And then some. It's just a horrible, horrible disease. And you're right. Just in the 20th century alone, smallpox may have been responsible for 500 million deaths.
Yeah. Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. George, I can't, you know, I mean, look, I've seen my brother die. I've seen my parents die. And I don't think there's any good ways to die. It's my unfortunate analysis of this, but I tell you this, there's no worse way to die than smallpox. It is horrendous. And even the most reasonable version, like the garden variety of smallpox, has a 30%, you know, strike rate. One in three people that get it will die. But there's a version called hemorrhagic smallpox, which is colloquially known in the, you know, in medical science as sledgehammer smallpox. That's got 100% strike rate. Nobody recovers from that. And it's where the blood hemorrhages, all of your blood vessels hemorrhage, and your skin lifts off of your skeleton. It is excruciatingly painful. There's nothing that can be done. There is no cure for smallpox and of any version of smallpox. And that has been a huge mistake, again, not of the American government, of all the Western world, that once it was adjudged to be eradicated, we destroyed the vaccine and all research into finding a cure stopped because it wasn't necessary. So anybody that can reconstitute it just just like they did the polio virus in upstate New York. Anybody that can reconstitute it has, you know, well, a free run home. There's, you know, there's nothing much we can do.
This this hatred toward humanity, which would unleash something like smallpox or any other bioweapon, why are they doing this? I mean, why is there so much hate, Terry?
Yeah, it's very hard for us to understand. But the last real, I mean, leaving the Syrians out, using it against their own people, you know, which is beyond belief. But the last real attack using a biological weapon was on the Tokyo subway system, a nerve drug called sarin.
Sarin, that's right.
Yeah, and it was manufactured by a cult in Japan who decided to use it against their own people and launch this attack on the subway. Well, one of those guys was a doctor and one was a physicist. So we're not talking about, you know, unqualified people here. They manufactured it and released it on the subway. Well, the problem with sarin is that it's a nerve agent, and it has to touch you in order to work. So it's really limited by the number of people that you can physically, you know, hit with this stuff. Mm-hmm. So if you're dropping in a bomb, you're going to sort of do reasonably okay. But if you just start chucking it around in a subway, you know, that's not so effective. The problem with smallpox is that it is highly infectious, and it's transmitted virtually by people breathing and coughing, just like a common cold. So why would somebody do such a thing to their own people in Tokyo with a relatively ineffective agent, let alone thinking of doing it to other members of humanity? It's a tough question, because why would a group of Japanese guys do this? I think it's sort of crazy. Then I traveled a lot through the Middle East, and the level of hatred, and it's not just against America. America is the symbol of it. It's a level of hatred against the Western world. And it is not shared by everybody you speak to by any means. But there are people there who wish us very, very ill. I have to say that a lot of that is driven by the Western world's, you know, energy policy, you know.
Mm-hmm. And occupations. Yes. I mean, it backfires on us, I think, all the time. Mm-hmm. I mean, for example, if one wants to believe that the 9/11 hijackers were indeed the ones that they told us, and, you know, there's a camp out there that doesn't believe that, but let's assume for a moment that they were the ones. You know, there's this tremendous hatred toward us. The Taliban once were the Mujahideen that we supported to try to get the Soviets out of Afghanistan, and then eventually they turned on us. I mean, nothing makes sense anymore, Terry. What's up is down, and what's down is up.
Absolutely. And one of the root causes of all of this is, you see, in the Western world, we tend to think that one of the bedrocks, I think, of our system of organizing a society or, of, you know, government or the way we interact with government is a separation between, you know, state and church, that religion will not play a part in our political life. Okay, that's true, I guess, in America. It's certainly true in Australia. It's, you know, it's something that's adopted through most of the Western world. In the Muslim world, religion and the state are the same thing. To talk of separating them is just about the worst thing that you can do. You know, I mean, if you renounce your religion in a number of Islamic countries, I mean, that is, you know, a death sentence. They believe that the state is, or the government is best organized when it is inextricably intertwined with their religion. Well, I guess it's their country and they have a right to organize it any way they want. But we have this fundamental disconnect between how we think things in the Western world should be organized and how they think things should be. The more we interfere, the more it is seen not just as an attack on their country, but an attack on their religion. And that becomes a very, very potent weapon if you wish to enlist people in, you know, in some sort of war against the Western world. You know, and we have this view in the West, which is, I think is completely erroneous, that, you know, we're dealing with people who are, you know, in many cases, relatively primitive, at least from our point of view, or, you know, they're sitting around with an AK-47 in a cave and that. Not true. Al-Zawahiri, the number two person in Al-Qaeda, was a medical doctor. There's any number of people you can find in those type of groups who are highly educated people. As I said, the guys in Tokyo were a physicist and a doctor. It wasn't like, you know, they were not, you know, illiterate people. That's where the danger is coming from. That, you know, we're going to deal with people who are going to make, you know, a lot of, you know, 9/11.
How can we fight something like that? You can't, can you?
In all honesty, you have to find a political solution. You can't fight them. That's the history of terrorism in the world. It's the history. I mean, the best example we have is Northern Ireland. You know, the attacks against the England, you know, against the mainland. I mean, horrific bombings that went on for years, you know, each one more spectacular than the one before. And sooner or later, you're going to have to look at the underlying causes, and you're going to have to come up with a policy will take account of that. I'm not very hopeful, but I think that's the way forward.
I'm convinced, Terry, that if we solve that dilemma, that problem, that special interest groups would then create terrorism because they needed something. You know, be it the multinational corporations, whoever. I think terrorism will never go away, because even if the real terrorists were gone, I think some of them would be fabricated.
It certainly suits a lot of people's purposes. It suits a huge number of people's purposes, and none more so than, you know, than multinational energy corporations.
That's right. Terry, we're at the top of the hour. Hold on. We're going to come right back. Two more to go on Coast to Coast AM.